not to steer the conversation in any particular direction. Someone volunteered to me during Shiva a psak in the name of Adam Gadol, which I wondered whether it was being accurately represented, that without any kind of differentiation, without any kind of nuance, so the psak that was volunteered, not requested, but the psak that was volunteered was that when it comes to a rabbi interacting with Talmidim, so on Purim or Bechlal, during the year, that Avelis shouldn't impose any constraint. And if the rabbi dances with the Talmidim ordinarily in Purim, so he should dance when he's in Avelis and on Purim also. Whatever he would do, he should do regardless. I can imagine that maybe the Adam Gadol said it in a certain context, maybe with a certain type of Talmidim, a certain lack of alternative, maybe, the question as to when a person's, whether a person's Avela should interfere with Shibudim that he has. But what seemed so off the mark is, and I think it's the Yisod transcends this particular context of Avelus and these dinim is, so I just asked them, so who teaches the Talmidim how to observe those Avelus? Like, it's all fine and good that you have to show the Talmidim, but who teaches the Talmidim Hilchos Avelus? I don't think the Yisod is limited to this particular example or the context of Hilchos Avelus. Let's say, sometimes some people have a shita that as parents, so one of their primary obligations is to be mechanech the children in Kibbutz Avayim. So they ask the kids to do things and they drill into them, Tati says so, Abba says so, you gotta listen. Okay, so one hears that. But there's also a din in Shulchan Aruch, the Mechaber din and Mata din, that parents are not supposed to be machbir ulam on children. Parents are not supposed to be demanding of children. They're not supposed to ask from children. They're not supposed to be machbir ulam. So if the parents are so busy being mechanech the kids for kibbutz avayim, so who's being mechanech the kids for how they're supposed to act as when they become parents? A sort of, imbalance in terms of tilting towards one side. But please, that wasn't intended to. It's intended just to break the ice, not to steer the conversation in any particular direction.
We're just hearing a stirring, surreal drasha from the Rav, maybe along the lines of what you just spoke about, in terms of saying over Sikor, it's more than just teaching over Limud HaTorah, but you're transcribing your teaching a more experiential. How do you best convey that to children? The Rav was speaking more than just Limud.
I think what he meant. It was a leitmotif of his You have in some of the written works also, you have that famous passage in Vikashta Misham. You have it also in the posthumously published English book, Abraham's Journey, the beginning of it, also about, we're not looking for archaeological evidence of Avraham Avinu, you know, he's a living reality. So I think that the way it's done is, let's take what seems to be a less demanding challenge than making the past come alive. So how does a Rebbe transmit a passion for Talmud Torah? He can't give a shmooze and say you got to be passionate about Talmud Torah. If he's passionate, and very genuinely so, it's contagious. The passion that the Rebbe, that the father has for Talmud Torah, is contagious, and then Memela, the sons, the Talmidim, become infected. And I think that the same is true for that dimension that the Rebbe used to talk about. If we relate to something as a living reality, you know, as opposed to a historical record, if we relate to it as a living reality, so then I think that's what our kids see it as. I don't think it's a question of being Noah Doresh, I think it's a question of being Noah Mekayim in terms of the transmission. I think elsewhere, when the Rav talks about it, I'm not sure whether he said it in the longer, in the longer clip, he said that basically, he didn't consider this the pshat al derech hagod, al derech machshav. He considered this the pshat al derech halacha, because the mitzvah is zechir yitzias mitzrayim. So what zechir means is to remember what a person. Right? I can't remember. Absent this idea, I can't remember what happened 100 years ago because I wasn't here 100 years ago. But I can't remember what happened 100 years ago. And the mitzvah of Zechira, he said, no, the omek of what Zechira means is that a person has that sense of identification. The moshel, I think the way we're able to relate to it a little bit is, let's say, I think we all, whether through our parents, our grandparents, there are certain stories that we heard them tell and relive about their experiences. We've all had that experience, right? Parents, grandparents, and certain stories, experiences that they had that stood out, that stand out in their minds. And we've heard the story enough that we sort of feel that we were there also. We have a feel for it. But it comes from the exposure to someone who feels that way, and then that gets communicated. That gets transmitted. We can't give it. We don't have.
As parents age, so does one balance the mitzvah and the very important principle of kibud avim in terms of trying to help them with the desire to make sure that they don't become dependent? I assume that there's like a healthy aspect of being independent. If you one can wind up in a situation where keep it out of aim almost makes them dependent upon your help, and then they lose their independence and impacts their quality of life.
That scenario, you know, sort of needs to be a bilateral effort. I don't know that you know, that the child unilaterally can determine that that result. I mean, you know, ideally, you know, at every stage of life, you know, once we, you know, once, you know, we're not small children. At every stage of life, a person is supposed to strive to be as independent as possible of all other people, and one's sole dependence should be upon HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's basically indicated in, that's what, when Chazal Darshan, Rashi quotes in Chumash, Avadahem v'lo avadim l'avadim, what it means is that if a person has any other dependence, it detracts from his sense of dependence upon HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If I feel dependent upon you, so to the degree that I feel dependent upon you, I don't feel dependent upon HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I feel dependent upon you. And for that reason, it's really a religious obligation for a person to be as independent as possible. And in every relationship, you know, when they're able to, children should be... you know, whether this, you know, when this means literally, you know, not to accept financial help, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about in terms of a mindset, in terms of doing things for oneself that one can, even, you know, minor, trivial things, like not to ask someone to do something for you. You know, if you want something from the refrigerator, to get up and get it from the refrigerator rather than having someone else do it. A person should be as independent as his health allows for, and that's it's very, very important, and you know, optimally, ideally, that's important to the parent, and because of that, you know, the child you know, is certainly not looking to in any way diminish that. That independence, you know, the reality of old age is usually, not always, but usually is not, I don't know how it's depicted in the storybook, you know, when Little Red Riding Hood comes, you know, Granny seems to be, or she would have been okay if not for the wolf, you know, she seems to be doing okay for herself. But the reality is that, you know, usually it comes with very real challenges. You know, very few people at 85, you know, are the way they were even at 75 or 65, Allah's coming earlier. And then, you know, one, obviously then, you know, the things shift, but one is always looking to allow for the maximum independence. You know, at points when the full independence isn't possible, so then one looks to that it should be done, you know, by respecting, again, all this needs to be adjusted to the situation, the personalities involved, etc., obviously. By giving the maximum dignity, because dignity is usually linked to independence, and dignity go hand in hand. So even when the independence is not fully possible, to stress the dignity, to stress as much as possible, you know, that the fact that the child may have to assume certain tasks, but shouldn't sort of usurp, you know, decision making, if that's still avoidable, and to sort of maintain the elements of independence as much as possible, you know, if the parent needs to be served dinner, you know, so do you want to eat now? Do you want to eat in a half hour from now? You know, that at least that, you know, element of decision making, which is also an element of independence. So one is always looking to uphold as much as possible, even when, you know, physical realities demand certain concessions. What happens if the parent, you know, is looking to be dependent? So obviously that's a very different challenge, and again, it's not going to follow exactly along these lines, but the goal is going to be the same. I think the goal is going to be for the, you know, in whatever way possible, to try to, you know, serve as necessary aid, but not as an unnecessary crutch. But again, you know, everything will be according to the situation and the personalities involved.
Turning that question in the other direction, when it comes to raising children, so also there is the dichotomy. On the one hand, you want to teach the children independence, and every child is different, and the goal is not to necessarily be a mirror image of your father or your mother or what they want. But at the same time, obviously, there's a lot of guidance, and kids don't necessarily know best, and even more so, you know, you're like Russ was talking about, you're trying to, you know, it's the father and the mother who are trying to write the story on the child. But the child wants to write their own story. And how do you know, or what's a little bit, are you so for guiding when to draw the line between those two tensions that are built in?
So maybe let's continue, maybe let's shift from the analogy of writing to the analogy of building. The parents, you know, are building foundations. You know, then the independence is going to be, you know, what's built upon the foundation. The child, yes, ultimately the child wants, and the parents want, that the child will make his own decisions in life, but it's the parent's responsibility to make sure that he has the basic emunah and the basic values and the basic hashkafas within which to correctly, you know, exercise his discretion, within which to express his individuality. And, you know, which is why, as the child gets older, you know, the parents, you know, the dynamic changes. You know, the Gemara in Kiddushin says, either by 22 or by 24, that, you know, it's hands off. But I think that's sort of the Kasar HaShlishi between the two, which level of the building we're talking about. But again, I think parents have to sort of, it also depends upon the child. How much, if at all, do you weigh your child's preference in terms of where he or she goes to high school? It, to, you know, in large measure depends upon how mature the child is. When, you know, when he or she is 13 or 14 years old, you know, whenever that decision is being made, if the child is mature, then it should be given a lot of weight. It should be given a lot of weight where the child wants to go. If the child is, you know, a little bit more of a late bloomer in terms of maturity, so then the parent should take into account what the child wants, but not only because that's something the parent needs to be mindful of. But kishala atzma, not necessarily.
Okay. Related to Rabbi's opening comments, in terms of being chanech about avelos, is it, you know, what sometimes one sees at Shiva houses where the avelim and the menachos, sometimes they're reminiscing, or schmoozing, or, you know, how are the kids, this, that. do we say that, you know, each abo kind of copes in their own way, or should really the focus be on the mace? And
there are objective guidelines for avelus. There's an issa hasat hadas. The only reason avelim don't go outside, that's not one of the nihugi avelus per se. That's to ensure the hasat hadas. The American, and probably Western, not just American, but the Western approach towards death is one of denial. People are not buried in cemeteries, they're buried in memorial parks, as though they're having a picnic for what's going on for 200 years, as opposed to being interred. There's now a push for above-ground burial. It's less jarring. It's also a form of denial. So we've been affected by that. So we think that nicham avela means distracting the other. So you talk about everything but. And given the nature of nicham avela, in the sense that people whom you haven't seen for so long, you know, it's... So it becomes a reunion, it becomes a family reunion, it becomes a class reunion, it becomes... But there are objective guidelines in general, even when all of halach is, you know, objective norms for subjective experience. That's what all of halach is. And the avelus is no exception. In general, you know, mitzvahs which... every mitzvah can and ultimately should be experienced, but sort of the dimension of experience is not the same in every mitzvah. You can eat matzah absent some kind of emotional experience. It's very meaningful. Is it ideal? You know, if there's no, I don't know what Reb Chaim was thinking when he asked Kazayas. I don't know what he was experiencing, and obviously, you know, the mitzvah Achilas Matzah for him was on a different level than for us. But what we do is not bad. What we do is not bad. We sit down and read a Kazayas Matzah. That's a very good thing. That's a very good thing. But there are some mitzvahs where absent the experience, it's just it's an empty shell. It's hollow. And we don't do so well with such mitzvahs. We're too quick to, excuse ourselves from making the effort. You know, Avelus Rachmanan Litzlan is one example. The other end of the spectrum, Tefillah, is another example. You know, where the mitzvah becomes a hollow, empty shell, absent, you know, the inner experience. You know, basically, that's the idea that the Talmid Rabbein Yonah saying brachos, that even if you hold mitzvahs ein tzrichos kavana, it doesn't apply to saying a bracha. And that's what he's saying. What he's saying is that there are some mitzvahs where most mitzvahs, achilas matzah without an inner experience is not empty. Again, you know you're doing l'shem mitzvah. You're doing l'shem mitzvah. That's a very meaningful experience, even if a person can't and doesn't elevate it to Reb Chaim's level of achilas matzah. But what Talmid Rabbein Yonah is saying is, but to say a bracha and not know that you're saying a bracha and not sort of relate to I'm thanking Rosh Hashanah with this bracha without that sense of, I don't know, we don't do so well with those mitzvahs. We don't do so
well. Rabbi, speaking before, but your question, Akiva, that Avayim and Chinuch, to put that together, what does someone's raising children, their parents, and let's say that so the parents, the grandparents, sometimes model behaviors or speak or present things in ways that that the parents would rather not, the children not see or shield the children from. So on the other hand, to minimize contact with the grandparents or to be, it doesn't make sense to tell the explain to the children that this is wrong. Did we, is there, and at some point maybe, or is that something that could be only in very extreme situations, because you want to express to you both objectively and cynically that that's what the parents with the special weapons.
Again, all these things need to be individualized, and it depends upon the kid, but kimduma, the by and large, I'm sorry, let me first take one step back. Sometimes, a course of Hashlishi is to choose the occasions. Again, as you said, obviously it isn't an option to exclude grandparents. It's not an option on any level. It's not, even supposedly in the name of chinuch, that's not chinuch, and it certainly, one has no right to deprive grandparents of seeing, interacting, having connection with grandchildren. So it's not an option. Meidach gisa, I don't know. Somewhat extreme example. Let's say, the Seder is not a proper Seder. The Shabbos is not a proper Shabbos. So the Kosovo Shlishi sometimes is going to be, okay, so you find different occasions. Instead of going for the Seder, l'havdil, you go for Thanksgiving. With that isn't an issue. Again, everything is b'mido mishkal. The fact that the Seder is not 100% exactly the way the parents would run the Seder, that doesn't mean that that a substitute needs to be found. But let's say it's night and day, and it's just not a proper Seder. The Sibur Yitzchak Mitzrayim is 15 minutes, and then the meal is 3 hours with Sichah V'Teila. Take an extreme example. Okay, so then you sort of substitute, other times. And the occasions, you substitute Mother's Day, Father's Day, and all other, or maybe if it's appropriate, Stam Shavuos, Chol HaMoed, you look to whatever contextually makes sense. Sometimes that's a cause of a shlishi. Let's say it's something which it's not so much that it directly affects the children, such as what the Seder is, what the Shabbos table is, but it's more just being exposed to a certain example. The grandparents don't dress the way the parents would like to see their children dress, or something like that. So that's really very different, when it's just more a question of being exposed to an example, albeit, an example within the family, which is very different than just seeing it on the street. But that's very different than, where the Seder is not proper. Again, sometimes it doesn't happen, but I think Ruba de Ruba it does happen. When the parental home is a good one, in the sense that the parents are consistent in their values, they're consistent in their behavior. They have a good, loving relationship with their children, where they command respect, not demand respect, but they command respect. So then the children see. And as they get older, so they understand that people are not perfect, And because people are not perfect, relationships can't be contingent upon perfection. And you know, we don't only love our grandparents if we agree or endorse everything they do. And on the contrary, I think they usually get it on their own. And throughout life, they're going to see, no one lives in such a cloistered environment, they don't see examples that run contrary to the chinuch they're getting. So what does it come down to? It comes down to if the parents commanded respect, so then, you know, the values get instilled in the kids, and I don't think they're going to, by and large, you know, they're going to dress the way the parents taught them, not necessarily by the different example that the grandparents may be setting. Maybe those are some of the guidelines. Yeah, are we supposed to be stopping now? Yeah, I think so. 3:50 we were supposed to stop. Okay. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much.